There is one instance in this episode of Nick getting overexcited and saying a rude word, but he very quickly follows it up with rainbows and unicorns. So I hope none of you will be offended. Before we start, if you could just say your first and last name to make sure I pronounce it right, and give pronouns if you want to give pronouns, and that would be great.
Thank you. I'm Nick Coveney, and my pronouns are he, him, his.
Hello, and welcome to Shelf Healing, UCL's bibliotherapy podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Markwick. Our guest today is Nick Coveney. Nick is a digital content expert, passionate about tech, books, and computer games. He is currently the Publisher Relations and Contents Lead for Rakuten Kobo in the UK, Australia and New Zealand. Formerly, Nick worked at Hachette UK, Bonnier Publishing and HarperCollins. In 2014, he was selected as one of the Booksellers Rising Stars and was selected as the inaugural London Book Fair Trailblazer Award winner in 2016. Our first question to get us started is nice and easy. Do you feel that reading is therapeutic?
I mean, it goes without saying, yes, of course, massively so. I think that, you know, depending on the individual and what they're reading, the therapy can be different. And, you know, sometimes people want pure escapism. Sometimes they want to be challenged or questioned or to question their own world order and reality. So yeah, I think all reading is therapeutic for me personally, but sometimes that is in a more abrasive or confrontational way. And sometimes that's in the more sort of like, this is in my comfort zone. This is something I shall enjoy. And I just get to live through those characters and escape into that universe for a while, which is in itself for me quite therapeutic.
Yeah. What kind of books then do you reach for if you want to relax or maybe be a bit more abrasive?
Ah, that's a good question. So my go-to very much is rooted in fantasy and sci-fi. I love the sheer escapism of fantasy worlds. I think if reading is an exercise in using your imagination, I would argue that, you know, fantasy and sci-fi is for the more ambitious or purists, because the author is asking you to do more work. You know, like you're going on a journey together, but you're going to travel further and maybe, you know, farther than you expect. So you're more active, whereas I find reading things which have too much of a contemporary setting or even a historical setting, a lot of work goes into creating those books. I'm not calling them lazy, but I think for a reader, they're slightly less demanding because you're going to the known. You know, you're going to a known period of time or a known experience, even if it's a, you know, a cliche or a caricature. You're relying on kind of like pre-perceptions to do some of the work, whereas with a lot of fantasy and sci-fi, you know, there are no limits. So you're going to have to do more imagining to get there with the author. But in terms of challenging stuff, it would be like, you know, dark, gritty, political stuff. That would be more challenging for me because those are things that, you know, I can enjoy, but they're not my go-to.
Yeah. Do you ever combine the two and go on a Peter F. Hamilton binge with dark, gritty, political and sci-fi? And some of them are fantasy.
Sometimes. I mean, my biggest challenge these days is that I just have a glut of brilliant books to read. So, you know, I'm very, very fortunate in that I have no shortage of things on my TBR pile. The problem really is that I will just like never get there. There are always books sort of shunting their way to the front. From a personal indulgence thing at the moment, I'm very much here for the big upswing of queer books, which we might come onto later on, and specifically sort of queer YA, which just didn't really exist as a genre 20 years ago when, you know, when I was a lot younger and could have perhaps enjoyed it as the original audience rather than being someone in their mid-30s who reads YA fiction. But never mind. I think that, you know, things like that are really positive as well. So, yeah, that I try and be broad with my tastes, but I'm probably more likely to go to things that I know I'm going to love straight off the bat. So that gets a cue jump.
Yeah. I think that knowing that you're going to love it, I think that's a big part of reading for well-being. You know, if you've had a bad day, even if you've got 6 or 7 books on the go, you're going to go for the one that you know you're going to love.
Precisely.
Over something that might be different. Is there a book in your life that has profoundly affected you?
Oh, so many. If I was going to pick one specific book, I would actually say It by Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a little bit of sort of trauma connected to that. But part of it is that, you know, I read it when I was very young to be reading it, both the title and the book. So I was, I think, 9 years old when I stole it from my dad's library, which, you know, in itself could be a story. And was, you know, horrified by the incredible intensity of, you know, really, it is all about fear of society, fear of each other, fear of our sort of darker demons. And without wanting to be too spoilery about it, you know, how we confront those fears, both as kids and, you know, teenagers, and then as grown adults. And I've reread it multiple times, but one of the things about it, which is so compelling for me, is the kind of merging that Stephen King does incredibly well. I've always been a huge Stephen King fan, despite the trauma of reading that book before. the kind of merging of human psychology with fantastical or horror elements. So, you know, Pennywise and everything that it represents is incredible and almost like infinite in its capacity to be cruel and scary. But then there's also like the fear of Derry itself and the way that kind of place has an evil vibe and brings out the worst in people. And then the way the characters react to that and how it brings out the best in them. I find it quite inspiring on some levels. The other thing was that, you know, as a kid who'd been subjected to far too many religious schools, you know, you already have that kind of like inbuilt fear, I think, as a queer youth, particularly before such things were, you know, even in the lexicon. So as a closeted kid who, you know, knew deep down that they were gay but didn't have the words for that, reading a book that has, you know, a brutal homophobic killing in it and a lot of internalized homophobia / same-sex attraction in a couple of the key characters was really challenging for me, but it certainly left a mark. I wouldn't say scarred for life, but, you know, the scars are there.
And if you're going to go for a horror, go for the classic,
right?
You know, the king of horror and quite possibly one of his best books, I think, in it.
Definitely.
As can be seen by the many film adaptations that have been attempted. And it's such a terrifying character. Like you say, it's not so much the character, but it's all the psychological things around the character that's terrifying. Because if they weren't afraid, if there was no fear, then it wouldn't be quite as effective, I think, a scary clown.
Again, we're going into sort of spoilery territory here, but actually like the undoing of it is when they realize that, you know, confronting fears and neutering them with ridiculous or fantastical stuff that makes them completely almost, you know, laughable or pathetic is part of how we, you know, as humans can cope with those psychological demons that we build up and reduce their power and get past them. So I love everything. If people haven't read it, I suggest they do, but maybe when they're feeling brave.
And if you're not a fan of horror, read it in the daytime. Don't read it before bed.
Yeah, and avoid rainstorms, yellow jackets, sewer drains.
Yeah.
There's a whole load of things to think about.
Yeah. Are there any books that you return to other than It over and over again that's like a comfort food but a book?
So I'm going to be very, very measured in how I say this. There used to be two series that I obsessively returned to, and I used to do stress rereads. So like as a sort of challenge to myself, when I felt stressed, I would go to the beginning of one of these two series and almost like race myself to finish rereading the entire series. And then I would always feel better because by going on that nostalgic journey, by revisiting those favorite characters, by having the kind of comfort feel that only really comes with a known narrative, I find like, you know, books that you love and keep rereading, it's almost like wearing a pair of comfy shoes or slippers. You kind of sink into them. You can enjoy, and it's, you know, just like replaying a favorite computer game or rewatching a favorite film or TV series. There's a kind of hormonal response in terms of the pleasure you get in having something that you know you love. You know where it's going. So there's no kind of risk or fear. You just get to enjoy the journey again. But for me, there is now only one series. So I shall let listeners guess what the first one was. But due to problematic and quite damaging toxic behaviors of the author and their decision to politicize a minority community, I no longer read or engage as a consumer with that world, which is an enormous, it was like, you know, cutting out a chunk of my heart. I can't emphasize enough how much that for me as an individual was a challenge, because I am of a certain generation who read the books when they first published, year being 1997, that, you know, really meant that I was invested in that world. I grew up with that universe. And for me, it meant an enormous amount. But I cut it out of my life because I actually find now that because of those actions, if I were to reread it, I know that the pleasure would be gone. So rather than it being something that I could enjoy and appreciate the nostalgia for, I would be fretting about the influence that that author has over international politics and the safety of the minority community that they are endangering. So for me, I have just cut it from my life. The series that I return to that I still love and I really, really hope, fingers crossed, that I can continue enjoying forever is His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. So if, Philip Pullman could just continue being the brilliant good egg that he is, and I can continue enjoying the universe now of His Dark Materials, because obviously it's been expanded. In my extreme youth, it was the original trilogy, and now the two newer entrants in the series, which are also brilliant, quite different.
Such a big time jump as well, because I'm a similar generation to you with that original trilogy of His Dark Materials. And it was a very long time later that I feel like, especially people rooted in science fiction and fantasy, we appreciate long gaps between books, because lots of my favorite authors publish one book every 5 years in an ongoing series that's heartbreaking when they leave it on a cliffhanger or they do something and everyone just sits there in shock and going, oh my goodness. But His Dark Materials original trilogy was so beautifully done and so nicely wrapped up that then to be given more books in that universe that are so well written is an absolute delight.
Yes.
Absolute delight.
Yeah. And I think that there was a real sort of surprise joy, because as, you know, fans of that franchise, we've been put through the ringer with a very, very lackluster, diluted Hollywood adaptation.
It was so
diabolically
bad.
It's just sort of like, how, if there's a 101 for listeners on how not to do a movie adaptation of a book series, it's like remove all of the compelling things that make that universe special to appease hardcore right religious extremists in Hollywood and think that it's going to be a good film, because it was not a good film nor a successful franchise entrant. And that's despite having, you know, incredible special effects, a killer cast, some very, very melodramatic rewriting of source material. I just feel like, you know, the BBC / HBO adaptation I have very much enjoyed, and it's far more sort of in the true spirit of the source material. But I actually, again, dating myself terribly here, but when I was a student studying drama at A-level, I got to go to the National Theatre and enjoy the incredible adaptations of His Dark Materials at the National. And that was really, really compelling as well. But yeah, I love revisiting that world. Again, it was enormously influential for me. That was probably one of the first times I saw a positive representation of a same-sex couple in the two angels who appear in The Subtle Knife and then The Amber Spyglass, Barthelmess and Borup. And I also found that, you know, the representation of homosexuality on the alethiometer was really important to me. So, like, you know, having it a sort of iconograph like that as a key part of the universe, that, you know, there are queer people in this space. I was about 10, I think, when I first read that book. So, you know, knowing that was, again, really, really important for me, and something that means that when I return to the series, I come with, you know, the expectation of enjoyment, but also knowing what's ahead of me. So I get to enjoy it twice as much.
Yeah. And again, I think the sci-fi and fantasy world generally is very good in that respect for queerness and difference. I think they're much more willing and able to tackle it from a, this is just standard in this world that I have created, that I find particularly interesting when compared to, like you said earlier, some of those more abrasive books, or those books that when you read them again, having found things out about the author, you suddenly go, oh, there's something missing. There's something very obviously missing, rather than the worlds and worlds where it's just standard, you know, all of these random alien genders that it's like normal. Why are you making a big deal about it? There's no big deal at all. I think Orson Scott Card as well is one of those problematic authors. And yet when you read The Enders, Quartet, which I still recommend to people with the caveat, you have to appreciate what he did, but take him away from them.
Yeah.
Because I think they are so interesting and important in so many ways that they do need removing from Orson Scott Card, who was a very problematic individual.
Yes.
Because he still deals with the idea of relationships and the idea of oneness and togetherness in such an interesting way, I think. It's important.
Yeah, I definitely see that. And, you know, I try and be of the thing that, you know, there are no bad books. I would still recommend even the series that I no longer revisit to people if I feel like they might be interested in, you know, magic and, you know, journeys and finding your tribe in terms of a friendship group, overcoming things and growing as a collective. But I do think it's really important that people remove the author from it. And almost like if they're going to reclaim the book, then you kind of have to acknowledge that the authors are problematic and that they're not necessarily great people. And obviously no author should feel obligated to be a great person. If you want to hate minority groups and attack them, then that's on you. But if you've got the freedom of speech to do that, then you should acknowledge freedom of critique from people who might call out you misusing your platform to harm other people who maybe could just do without the interference.
A lot of people find reading helps their well-being because they see themselves or their situations in the books. Is this something, I think it is, that you find is the case with you when you're reading?
Yes and no. I find, you know, I love the escapism of putting myself out of my head or welcoming extras and special guests inside my head so that they get to occupy it for a while rather than me overthinking about 1,000 things at once. But I think that it's kind of like a mixed bag for me because I have empathized with a lot of characters. And I kind of have a very emotional response when I do empathize with an element to a story or even a character arc, even if it's completely outside my known experience. If there's something in there that I can relate to, then that really sort of gets my synapses flaring in a positive way. And I enjoy, you know, really engaging with that world. But that said, you know, growing up, there was a real lack of characters I could relate to directly. And I think that, you know, that's finally beginning to be redressed now. But I also kind of feel like it's challenging because there are lots and lots of new books coming out, some of which are doing, you know, incredible things and telling great stories. But the ones that get propagated in kind of like mainstream media tend to be very set flavors. And I feel like it's difficult because what we don't want is to have certain sort of like mega franchises pushing the idea that there is one form of queerness or one form of X. So, you know, yes and no. I find myself in books, but sometimes I feel like I have to do far more work as a reader or a listener doing that, finding the common ground, than perhaps I should. And, you know, I'm very pleased that there's more diverse publishing coming to the front now. But I feel like growing up in particular, you know, outside His Dark Materials, and the slight trauma of it, that there weren't a lot of representations I could find actually then for same-sex couples.
That's interesting. I mean, that there's what you say about the sort of the stereotyping of this is the acceptable queer that we want in our books. Because like you say, there's a vast number of books now with queerness embedded as part of their soul that cover a whole variety of different types of queerness, but the mainstream perhaps isn't getting all of those.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, like the books are now beginning to be published, which is fantastic. But the ones that get the huge marketing spend, the ones that get the attention and the limelight, as it were, in terms of the adaptations and the film, you know, or the Netflix series, I find to be perhaps more stereotypical or more heteronormative in some ways. So they might have a same-sex couple pairing at the heart of the story, but they will conform in every other way possible to a very kind of Magnolia vanilla existence to you know, not offend the straights. And that in itself feels like a regressive step because there is so much diverse queer fiction and nonfiction coming to the fore now. It would be great to see all of it getting the attention it deserves rather than the trend that seems to be at the moment, like what is most palatable because it's safest to people's world order, that's the stuff that gets prioritized because it's not going to offend anybody. Or the or let's put it another way, the only people that will offend is the extreme hardcore of people who find the very notion of LGBTQ plus people offensive. So they're clearly not the target audience. But I feel like if you look at, you know, other forms of media, and a great example would be It's a Sin by Russell T. Davies. That's very boundary pushing and has received, you know, widespread acclaim and a very positive response sort of globally now. But it was going into a kind of cultural vacuum because there aren't many portrayals of that period for queer people living in London during the early emergence of the AIDS crisis in the, you know, mid to late 80s and early 90s. There is a complete black hole almost culturally. And, you know, as someone who grew up under Section 28, this is really challenging because, you know, I was still one of the last people to go through the UK secondary school system with that law in place, which meant that when I was outed when I was 15, I had some teachers who were, you know, actively homophobic and hostile towards me because they felt like legally they were entitled to be bigoted towards me because they weren't promoting it. And there's this whole idea that, you know, if you celebrate or feature other worldviews, that you are promoting or propagating them. That is not how culture works. And that is not really how it works for cishet narratives. So the nicest possible way, I don't think anyone's coming for Gillian Flynn over Gone Girl and saying, look at what you're promoting.
No.
In terms of celebrity culture and marriage, it wouldn't happen. Whereas if that was a queer narrative, you know, you would worry that there might be perhaps some criticisms that they were problematizing or pushing harmful stuff. And it's like this whole thing needs to be debunked, I think, because it feels like there's one set of rules for straight fiction and another set of, you know, almost conformist rules that maybe more limited playbook in terms of what is or isn't permissible in fiction. And, you know, I think some of it is cultural. For all of its brilliance, like, there are very problematic parts to that book. And I honestly feel like an openly queer author would be lynched if they wrote something similar in terms of some of the interactions in that book. And I think, like, it's really interesting to kind of like mull over why that is and why one thing is kind of like more hypothetical or more permissible than another. I'm in no way kind of commenting on the rightness or wrongness of that. I think there are very problematic things in a lot of great books, and some of those perhaps should be scrutinized. I think, you know, authors have gone on record sort of saying, well, I wouldn't write it like that now because they're more aware now of what it is that they're potentially including. But I do think that it's interesting that there's those separate rule books.
Mm. You've kind of answered my next question, which I'm going to reframe, which was, over the last years, you've written a lot about inclusivity and diversity in the publishing world.
Yeah.
Have you seen this move into the books being published, which obviously we have? But I kind of want to reframe that a little bit in sort of the sense of, I think, what you're talking about, which Zain Yao's episode, she talks a lot about the ethnographic reading of books and the sense of entitlement for getting something from it, from getting something of that life. And that if people don't put that in, they feel somewhat cheated and angry about it. And mm-hmm. I think that links quite nicely with what you've been saying about the separate rule books that go in, where the straight people feel entitled to get something from it, as opposed to just, there's a lovely bit in Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern. I don't know if you're a dragon fan, but there is some sort of homosexual relationships a little bit there that you see
that, as a cishet person, I
think it's nicely done, because it's like the mating rituals of the dragons, where some of them couple up and they're just like, they're together, they're guys, they're together, it's fine, it's normal. And it's the way it's stated, it feels very much just part of the world. It's not even worth making a deal out of, because there's nothing to make a deal out of. It's normal.
Yeah.
Which when I read it, I was very young when I read this, I was like, oh, that's cool, I like that, that's nice, you know, it's part of the world, it's inclusive. But I feel like you said, that sense of, if there was a queer author writing a book that showed problematic relationship, like you said, they'd be attacked for it, because there's that sense of entitlement that if you're going to show something different, you have to show it perfect, as opposed to being allowed to show the problems.
Yeah.
Think of all of those books where the crime books, you know, where there's stalkers happening and murdering people because they're a celebrity person or whatever. And that's a problematic relationship that, like you said, I think if you put the queerness in, becomes very difficult to get, not perhaps published, but accepted as this is an acceptable way to show problems exist in all relationships, regardless of whether they're queer or straight.
Yeah, and I feel like one of the things that irritates me, there's a couple of different issues, I think, in terms of just general minority groups in publishing. So obviously I am a cis white gay man, and therefore I can really only speak from experience as a gay guy. And as a gay man, I am incredibly fortunate in that I am, you know, cis presenting. I am probably, you know, most definitely part of the group with most legal rights and least likely to be at risk of marginalization or mistreatment. Doesn't mean that everything is rosy and that homophobia is over, but it's acknowledging that lesbian, bisexual, transgender and queer people in general, particularly like non-binary people, can have all sorts of other challenges that I cannot speak to from a place of experience. I can only, you know, retell anecdotes of friends or try and learn what those struggles are and how I can help people to the best of my abilities in representing them and raising their voices. I find one thing that is really challenging is like own voice narratives. And the idea that, you know, own voice shouldn't be something that people have to answer for. If someone is saying, you know, I feel like this is own voice, people should be given the benefit of the doubt. There's been a few high profile cases in America where people have almost been outed or pressurized into coming out in some capacity because something has been labeled as own voice. And then people have said, but they're cishet. And there's an assumption there that you can recognize externally the insides of someone's identity, which is incredibly toxic and problematic. At the same time, there is also the issue you were just mentioning, where I feel like there is a certain expectation that if queer creators make something, we have to make it for the mainstream. You know, it's our duty to make us more palatable to the mainstream, which is complete bullshit and not something that I truck with. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to swear, but I've just done it anyway. So if you need to bleep over that, please feel free. However, you know, this sort of double standard in terms of wanting us to entertain you in this rainbow gladiatorial ring with sparkles and glitter and unicorns, but only in a way which is inoffensive and doesn't challenge the world order and doesn't contain anything that might make you feel uncomfortable. We're not here to make you feel comfortable. And also, you know, people tell their own stories for themselves. And I feel like as an industry, we have to allow that to happen a bit more. I am not saying that, you know, no straight author should write a narrative with queer characters in it. But I do think that if those stories are written, they should expect some scrutiny from openly queer people as to, you know, what's the intent behind writing this? And what are you actually, you know, saying about an identity which you are apparently not. Now, obviously, as I just mentioned earlier on, sexuality and gender identities are not necessarily static. They're not necessarily fixed. For some people they are, for some people they're not. It's not really for anyone externally to make that moral determinism. What I find very, very worrying at the moment is that although there's a great new wave of diverse fiction and nonfiction coming through, and I feel like we are beginning to reach the point where most publishers now are moving beyond having, you know, a diversity shelf or a diverse list where they only have one imprint that might occasionally go for something a bit rainbow colored. It's now something more tangible where people are realizing that actually there are fantastic different, you know, ethnic diverse minority group queer stories that should be heard by everybody and that everybody can benefit from hearing and reading. The danger is there is also a rise in the counterculture. So, you know, there has been an upswing in terms of publishing books which are basically commodifying or commercializing hate speech. That is very toxic. And I think something that publishers have to be incredibly careful with. I have had a few instances where I've called out books which I believe to be belligerently transphobic or racist or any other form of attacking a minority community. And I feel like as individuals within the industry, that's kind of our job. Like, people should not expect that just because they think there's a market for something, they can publish there with impunity without people saying, actually, do you really want to be like pushing that into the mainstream? That's what you want to be contributing to moral discourse? This is the thing, you know, like particularly there have been a number of recent books announced or published which have been quite openly anti-trans. That is not an ideological point. That is not a hypothetical. That is not a point of discourse or dialogue. It is attacking a minority community who exist. Their existence, you know, might not go with some people's very small experience of what's acceptable in the modern world, but those people are real. They are living lives. They have rights and they are entitled to live in peace. And trying to problematize their existence or politicize it is incredibly harmful and, you know, not something I think nice publishing companies should do.
No, and also, if we bring this back to the idea of books for well-being, there's no comfort in that for anyone. Books no. that are very obviously pushing one particular agenda that is perhaps disagreed with by the vast majority. If people are trying to find themselves in books, they're trying to find stories that they can empathize with, that they want to be part of, regardless of whether you, like you said earlier, whether you are that person or not, but you find something of yourself in them, then writing a book which is so aggressively against anyone finding themselves in that book, the well-being effect, which is a huge, important, and I'd say pillar of reading, is lost entirely. And in a world that we're trying to improve people's well-being and make people feel better about themselves and see themselves more, it seems somewhat ridiculous to be platforming that.
I completely agree. And I think that, you know, there's a thing there where, unfortunately, the tabloid presses in this country and in other countries show that selling, you know, things that make people angry, it will sell. You know, we only have to look at the very troubled legacy of the Trump presidency and the rise of disinformation to know that, you know, you can monetize hate. That isn't actually a win, I would say. I actually think it's a cop-out. And I think, you know, any company that goes to someone because they're a right-wing talking head who will get people in Little England worked up about a non-issue because it's terrifying to them, that's just really lazy commissioning. That isn't a coup. That isn't being, you know, commercially savvy. That's actually just, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel and repackaging it. And you can do that. You know, no one is stopping these books from being published. But you have to remember that not every retailer will want to stock it. You know, I'm very proud to work for Rackert & Kobo, and I'm very proud to work for a company that has open content standards. So we have terms of service. We are very open about what we will and won't allow on store. And we won't allow anything that is going to harm a minority group to be sold on our store because it's our store. And, you know, we don't have to stock it. So I think people need to remember that as well. Like, people have freedom of speech, but people also have freedom to say, actually, no, thank you. We don't want to sell that dross here.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Rackert & Kobo. All of my ebooks are bought through Kobo because Kobo is the best, obviously.
Thank you.
Which leads me on to sort of a nice final kind of question. You work for Rackert & Kobo, who are entirely digital. They do audiobooks, they do ebooks. Do you find that this use of digital affects the way that you read, or affects the sorts of things that you will consume when you're reading for comfort?
So, I mean, I'm probably a bit of an outlier within Rackert & Kobo because my background, as you know, is in print publishers. Now, always in a sort of hybrid role. And by that, I mean that, you know, that there wasn't a box to tick when I first started working in the industry because I worked on physical and digital. And then that kind of morphed into specializing more and more in digital. And now, as you say, I work for a digital only retailer where we sell ebooks and audiobooks, but what we don't do is sell physical. We like to be the best possible digital bookseller. And for us, that means, you know, honing in on that experience and trying to sell the best ebooks and audiobooks. But for me as an individual, I still love physical books. I have multiple bookshelves, far more than my partner would like me to have in our house, which are, you know, teeming to the brim with books that I love. So for me, I think what it's done is I really read in different formats for different purposes. So it's kind of horses for courses. I e-read for pure escapism. And I e-read when I'm commuting, or, you know, back in such a time when I used to commute. Obviously, lockdown has kind of ruled that out for the time being. But I e-read for speed and for ease. So for me, if I want to read a new book, or I want to read something quickly, I will e-read it, because I can read very fast on my e-reader. And also, in terms of like ease of use, it's light, it's, you know, eminently portable, and it's very, very easy. If there's something where I'm a big series aficionado or a huge fan, I will probably buy, you know, the most plush hardback or physical edition going. But what I'll probably do then is buy the ebook or the audiobook as well, so that I can put that on its precious shelf and never touch it, or maybe go and give it, you know, like a loving stroke once in a while, but not crack the spine. I'm very bad for, you know, having multiple editions of the same thing.
You've got to have multiple editions, right? Because they constantly change the covers on these whopping great big series of things where it's always changed, you know, where you get halfway through like a six books in, and then they suddenly change all the covers. So of course you've got to buy all the
new ones. And this is the thing. I mean, like, I still enjoy reading physical books, and I will, you know, read a trashy paperback or whatever until the cows come home. But one thing I found is that I have kind of gravitated towards listening to audio when, you know, in the gym or traveling for long stretches of time, because that's nice and easy, and I can multitask more effectively, whether I'm, you know, going for a workout or doing something else. I e-read in general, so that's become my default mode of reading. And then I will scarcely read in physical form, but sometimes when I do, I just really appreciate that break. So, you know, I do enjoy reading an old-fashioned book occasionally, but it tends to not be a book that I'm completely in love with or care too much about, because I hate for anything bad to happen to it.
Yeah, that sense of, you know, it's a thing, isn't it? As opposed to just a book.
Yeah, precious.
Yeah, brilliant. Have you, I've started asking people this now because I like asking, have you got a book that you would recommend for people that you consider a great comfort book?
Ooh. Yeah, so The Universe versus Alex Woods.
Ooh, it's a good shout.
Yeah, it's a great book. I think it's pretty unique. I also have a special place for it in my heart because I did the casting on the audiobook way back when, and it has a brilliant, brilliant narrator. So I feel like, you know, that is a great shout, whether people want to e-read it, p-read it, or listen to it. And I think that, you know, it's got a lot of heart in it. And that's the thing, like, I love books that have a lot of soul to them, you know, whether it's romance, whether it's fantasy, anything where I really care about the lives and loves of those characters, even if they're not people, what they care and love, if I care about that, then I'm sold. So, and I definitely bought into Universe versus Alex Woods.
Yeah, it's great. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The end of a brilliant episode there with Nick Coveney. Some great book recommends, some super interesting thoughts on LGBTQ+ in publishing and diversity in books and how we read them. Great to chat to someone in digital about ebooks, p-books, and audiobooks. And I really second Nick's recommendation of The Universe versus Alex Woods. Do go check that one out. Thanks as always to Nicholas Patrick for our music, and I'll be back next week with another.